KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Our system, although the safest in the world, and although aviation is the safest mode of transportation, it is still shocking when a tragedy like this occurs.
A fatal mid-air collision is a rarity, but NPR has found that at Reagan National Airport, near misses often involve military aircraft.
It's Thursday, January 30th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump and other administration officials have claimed without evidence that DEI programs led to Wednesday's crash.
Diversity is integral to achieving FAA's mission of ensuring safe and efficient travel. I don't think so.
Also, we talk with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, who just had her third child and is the first Boston mayor to give birth while in office.
There's the expectation that someone's home or personal life should be kept very separate from what it means to be a working individual.
And in California, a webcam trained on an eagle's nest has a loyal human following.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Officials say there were no survivors in last night's collision between an American Airlines regional jet and an Army Black Hawk helicopter. A total of 67 people were killed. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman says there are questions being raised about why the two aircraft were flying in the same airspace over the Potomac River.
The Black Hawk was heading south along the Potomac in the direction of National Airport, and like the plane was in touch with the tower. Now, there's a flight corridor for helicopters, and the maximum height is 200 feet. But sources I talked with say it appears a Black Hawk was flying higher, maybe more than 100 feet higher at the time of the crash. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth would only say there was some sort of an elevation issue. The investigation, of course, will determine whether the helicopter was in the corridor and at the right altitude.
NPR's Tom Bowman, the National Transportation Safety Board, has recovered the aircraft's so-called black boxes. Lawmakers in Tennessee have passed a sweeping immigration bill to help with President Trump's mass deportation efforts. Mariana Bacalhau of member station WPLN in Nashville reports Tennessee joined states like Florida that are looking to collaborate with ICE.
The law will create a new state division to enforce immigration laws and $5 million in grants to incentivize local law enforcement agencies to partner with ICE to help arrest, screen, and deport migrants who are in the U.S. illegally. Also under the law, state officials can be removed from their positions and charged with a Class E felony if they vote in favor of sanctuary policies for immigrants. That's something the Trump administration has tried to crack down on, but the federal government only has so much power over local governments. State governments, however, do have that authority. Legal challenges to the law are expected, but state power could hold up. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacalhau in Nashville.
Republican and Democratic senators on the Intelligence Committee pushed Tulsi Gabbard to answer questions about Edward Snowden, who leaked NSA documents to journalists in 2013. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin reports Gabbard's past defense of Snowden might anger the U.S. spies she hopes to lead.
Former Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard faced over 2.5 hours of questions from senators who will be voting on whether they believe she is fit to serve as President Trump's Director of National Intelligence. Several asked about her record on foreign policy, like her decision to visit former Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in 2017, or excuses she's made for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Others focused on pushing Gabbard to condemn former NSA contractor Edward Snowden for leaking classified documents about U.S. intelligence operations. Gabbard said Snowden broke the law, but she refused to call him a traitor. She said he helped to expose illegal programs and inspired reform. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 168 points. This is NPR. President Donald Trump's pick to be Interior Secretary has been confirmed. Former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum facing little opposition. Burgum appears to have had a relatively cozy relationship with oil and gas companies during his tenure. That's based on emails obtained by the Associated Press. A spokesman for Burgum says the Republican routinely, quote, met with job creators and leaders who generated opportunities for the people of North Dakota. English musician Marianne Faithfull has died. She found fame in London's swinging 60s. And according to a spokesperson, the 78-year-old vocalist and actress died surrounded by her family in London. NPR's Felix Contreras has a remembrance.
Marianne Faithfull started her career in 1964 with the hit song As Tears Go By, which was written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards.
It is the evening of the day.
During the 1970s, she experienced widely publicized bouts with drug and alcohol before mounting a comeback in 1979 with the album Broken English. Later, she faced health challenges, including breast cancer, and in 2020, a hospitalization after contracting COVID. But she recovered, and she released her final album a year later. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
Dubai has cemented its status as the world's busiest airport for international travel, bouncing back from the coronavirus pandemic. Officials saying today the airport saw a record 92.3 million travelers last year. There are plans to move planes and terminals in 10 years to the city's state's second airport, which has undergone a $35 billion upgrade. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Sasha Favor. We begin this hour with the collision last night between a passenger plane and an Army Black Hawk helicopter in the skies over Reagan National Airport. The recovery efforts continue, and so does the investigation into what happened. It's being led by both the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board. A mid-air collision is a rare occurrence. There are also near misses. The FAA tracks those and calls them near mid-air collisions. What does this data tell us as we try to gain a better understanding of what happened? Robert Benincasa is with NPR's investigations team and has been looking into this. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Sasha.
What can you tell us about so-called near mid-air collisions?
Well, even those are pretty rare, but the FAA has a system for pilots and flight crews to report incidents where aircraft get too close to each other, and this could lead to a mid-air crash. So I looked at the database of those reports, and at Reagan, there were 30 near mid-air collisions reported since the late 1980s. What's a bit unusual here, though, is that of those 30, 10 of them involved military aircraft. And nationally, that rate is a lot lower. It's less than 25%.
And were any of those other near misses helicopters like this collision involved?
Yes. Seven of those reports involved military helicopters. And I wanted to put this a little bit more in context, so I spoke with Mike McCormick. He's the FAA's former director of safety and operations for the whole nation, for the nation's control towers. And he now teaches at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University.
There are helicopter routes that transverse the airspace around metropolitan Washington, D.C., designed for mainly use by military helicopters that are flying in and out of the various bases in the D.C. metropolitan area.
So he says that increases the chance that someone would see a near collision with a military aircraft.
And did he say anything about this crash specifically?
Well, he mentioned what could be some contributing factors. For one, the passenger plane was aiming for a different runway than usual and would have been turning. So this could have made it hard for that pilot to see the helicopter. And as for the helicopter, he said the pilot probably had difficulty seeing the plane. And he mentioned the lights of the city in the background and the fact that, you know, the altitude was low and you could see those lights in the background, which could have interfered.
It's like driving a car.
Yeah.
You have the responsibility when you're driving a car to look around you for all the other traffic. So you're operating the aircraft under the same basic premise. You're looking out your window for other aircraft and you turn to avoid them.
And Robert, we've been hearing that DCA Reagan is a relatively crowded airspace. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of compressed because there's a lot of restrictions around the Capitol. There are many places over Washington where you can't fly. And McCormick says the FAA is doing its own investigation that could lead to changes immediately or in the near term, even as the NTSB does that more lengthy investigation of the crash.
That's Robert Benincasa with NPR's investigations team. Thank you.
Thank you, Sasha.
And several members of U.S. figure skating were on the American Airlines flight, including members of the Skating Club of Boston. That club held a press conference this afternoon, and there to answer questions was Nancy Kerrigan, the one-time Olympian. She's an alum of that club, and she told reporters that she needed to be with members of her former club.
We just wanted to be here and be part of our community. The kids here really work hard. Their parents work hard to be here. But I feel for the athletes, the skaters, their families, but anyone that was on that plane.
Nancy Kerrigan speaking there at what you could hear was an emotional news conference. So the investigation into what caused this fatal air collision is just beginning, but almost immediately President Trump and other administration officials said diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at the Federal Aviation Administration were to blame. Trump also acknowledged he had no direct evidence that DEI had anything to do with the crash. This is not the first time opponents of DEI efforts have tried to tie DEI to a disaster, and I want to bring in NPR's Lisa Hagen to discuss why. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Mary Louise.
You have done some reporting about how DEI has become a sort of catch-all explanation for disasters, for tragedies. What else has been blamed on DEI?
Yeah, most recently, supporters of Trump's blamed the spread of wildfires in Los Angeles on DEI efforts at the LA Fire Department. We heard it as a critique of the Secret Service after assassination attempts on candidate Trump. We heard it after the Baltimore Bridge collapse last spring, and that list goes on.
Well, and it's interesting because in a lot of these cases, the facts are not known right away. Investigations require time. Why the seeming rush to tie DEI?
Yeah, I spoke with Ian Haney Lopez about this. He's a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the book Dog Whistle Politics. He says invoking DEI in this way is part of a larger effort to trigger resentment against groups that have been historically marginalized.
But to do so in terms that do not embrace a blatant, direct bigotry, but that instead seek to clothe themselves in some form of a commitment to fairness or excellence.
He says blaming DEI is shorthand for a story that America used to be based only on competence and meritocracy, which that's an inversion of our actual history of pervasive discrimination against people other than straight white men.
Back to this press conference today with President Trump. He seemed to be reading from the actual DEI inclusion policy, the actual diversity and equity inclusion policy at the FAA. What do we know about what it says about hiring practices there?
Yeah, so it's important to say those hiring practices were also in place under all of Trump's first administration. But here's another important thing. I spoke with a former FAA official today who wanted to remain anonymous because of retribution concerns. But that official pointed out air traffic control is a very specific job within the FAA. And those specialists go through very rigorous skills testing and a psychological evaluation before they're hired.
Just to step back, this second Trump administration has aggressively been trying to end DEI programs across the federal government, across the military. Can you just put into context, remind people what it is they're trying to get rid of, how DEI is supposed to work in practice?
So according to people who do DEI consulting, these efforts are trying to push workplaces toward meritocracy. It's things like standardizing hiring and promotion processes or writing scoring rubrics for candidates where often there weren't any before. And you often hear anti-DEI activists saying it's about hiring quotas, but those are actually illegal in the United States.
That is NPR's Lisa Hagen. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Science has gotten snarled in the political funding changes this week. A flurry of action by the Trump administration has scientists, agencies, and universities scrambling to understand the impact. NPR science correspondent Jonathan Lambert has been looking into this. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Sasha.
So how did all these recent moves by the administration affect the world of science?
So I follow the National Science Foundation, and on Monday I started hearing that dozens and dozens of meetings were being abruptly canceled. These meetings are to hash out which research proposals to fund, ranging from civil engineering to environmental science. And it's not clear now when or even if they'll resume, meaning that those projects are in limbo.
And why did the meetings get canceled?
So the NSF said that it needed to figure out how their grant-making process complied with Trump's executive actions, especially those that prohibited diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in federal contracting and spending. Then on Monday, the White House sent out a memo directing agencies to pause all federal grant spending while they figure out how to comply with executive orders. So it created a lot of confusion.
Yeah, I bet. But that memo, as we've reported, was rescinded. So has the funding flow resumed? Has it not kicked back in?
So it was rescinded on Wednesday, but the first action about DEI still stands. And as of when we're talking on Thursday, the National Science Foundation is still freezing existing funds for grants. And the reason it's so complicated for NSF specifically is because it's congressionally mandated to weigh how their grants will increase the participation of underrepresented groups in science. The Trump administration is saying, in effect, that it can't do that. And so that makes it a bit legally complicated.
Yeah. On a practical level, how is this affecting scientists and the work they're trying to do?
So on an individual level, some scientists are now unable to get paid money from grants that they've already won, money that also funds their rent and food. I spoke with one plant biologist who tried to withdraw the remainder of her yearly grant, something that she's legally allowed to do, on Friday. And she was notified yesterday that her funds were frozen. She spoke on the condition of anonymity because she fears speaking out publicly could jeopardize her career and her funding. She doesn't know when or if she'll get paid, and so can't go to her field sites in the Southwest, where she studies how plants are adapting to drier weather. And there are hundreds of researchers with her kind of grant in a similar boat right now. Most federal grants don't go directly to individuals, but to their institutions instead. And amid all this confusion, some universities are telling researchers to put certain aspects of their research on hold. Mm. One person in that situation is Peter Savage, an immunologist at the University of Chicago. His lab maintains a population of hundreds of mice to develop new cancer treatments.
If we really had a substantial stoppage or delay in funding, we would have to basically euthanize a lot of the mice. And that's sort of the equivalent of a farmer, you know, losing a crop for a whole season.
It would take months to rebreed those mice to do their experiments.
Wow.
I also spoke with Jonathan Stein at Penn State, who studies how to prevent fatty liver disease, a condition that impacts 100 million people in the U.S. He's worried about the jobs of the 15 people in his lab. And overall, given all that's happened in just the first weeks of the Trump administration, many scientists are extremely worried about the next 4 years.
I bet. That's NPR science correspondent Jonathan Lambert. Thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is used to firsts. She is the first woman to be elected mayor of Boston, first person of color to be elected to the post, and as of a couple of weeks ago, the first Boston mayor to give birth while in office, her third child. On Tuesday, Mayor Wu was back at City Hall, and as she got to work, her newborn, Mira, was in tow.
Oh my God! Wow. All right. It's been a great baby. Eats a lot. Sleeps a lot.
Eats a lot, sleeps a lot. Mayor Wu, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
How did that feel to be back at City Hall with your newest newborn babe in arms?
It was great to be back in the swing of things. I had been participating with my team mostly remotely up until that point since we welcomed our lovely new bundle, and to just be back in person felt really good. And
good.
Mira held her own. She participated in a cabinet meeting and just had one diaper issue that we needed to address, but it got taken care of pretty quickly.
And is this just business as usual for you? I mean, you've done this before. I read back when you were on the city council before you were mayor. So like a decade ago, you would come to work every day carrying your then infant son.
That's right. Mira has two big brothers and both were born after I was already serving on the Boston City Council. And so it brought back a lot of memories of being on the council floor or having a baby on my hip as we were going through the business of the city. We are very lucky in that City Hall is a site with on-site childcare, but there is a little bit of a lag time in terms of when they will start accepting new babies. And so for this transition period, it's a little bit of touch and go, but we do our best. And now with technology, with Zoom, there are even more ways to be engaged.
We were going back through the archives, and I saw that back when you first were doing this with a baby on your hip, this was like back in 2015, you gave an interview to CBS and described some of the pushback that you got for bringing your son to council meetings, council hearings at the time. Any pushback at all this time?
Well, I think we're still in a world where often there's the expectation that you have to have very strict boundaries in order to be professional, right? And that someone's home or personal life should be kept very separate from what it means to be a working individual.
Yeah.
And we know from the vast majority of jobs and industries that that artificial separation is not only impossible, but it also really holds us back as a society. We have come a long way since my first child was born. Back then, I had been leading the charge, and we did not have paid parental leave at all in place in City Hall. And so I authored the ordinance, passed that policy, and in the years since then, we've now been able to expand it to just about every city union as well through collective bargaining. And so a lot of those policies have now newly been implemented, and we're seeing the benefits.
May I ask the obvious question? You're talking about helping to lead the fight for paid parental leave. It doesn't really sound like you're taking it. Why not?
Well, I am a strong, strong proponent that every single person should have the full range of options to support what their family needs, what their personal health needs, and what their own judgment is. The job of being an elected official is a little bit unique and different. You're essentially on call, even on vacation, even in the middle of the night for important decisions that have to be made. And so I'm doing this in a way that works for my family, works for the city, and that I've frankly had a joy and just a huge privilege to be able to do because we have options in place.
So I'm well aware, Mayor Wu, that I might not have asked for this interview, that it would be less newsworthy if a male mayor of Boston had just welcomed a third child to the family. I'm also aware as a working mom myself that most dads aren't actually in there doing the childbirth and breastfeeding. There's some things you just can't delegate. I guess it prompts the question. I mean, Mira obviously is still tiny. She's, what, 14, 15 days old as we're speaking.
That's right.
But are you thinking already about what you might want her to know about what is possible for a working mother?
We're in such an interesting and also unpredictable and in many ways stressful time. As a woman, as someone who has a front row seat in the workings of politics and government right now, we're seeing the push and pull of many changes or even rolling back of policies that had been long fought for to protect bodily autonomy or individual rights and protections. As I was running for mayor towards the end of that election, you know, there were a number of very strong women involved, and my boys had grown up seeing the sea change of women in elected office that Boston had experienced over the last decade. And one of my sons asked me if boys were ever allowed to be mayor of Boston as well. And so I think we're seeing the impact that role models can have, and we want to make sure that that also turns into a tangible difference and the impact in improving people's lives.
So as you and I speak, you are running a re-election campaign for another term. And as I don't need to tell you, we are not living through a quiet moment for big city mayors in America. I was reading that you are one of four mayors who has been called to testify next month, February 11th on Capitol Hill, for a hearing on so-called sanctuary cities. Do you plan to go?
We're still reviewing the communication that was received and seeking some guidance from those who know the ins and outs of congressional policies and all of that best. I know that Boston has a lot to share when it comes to how our policies have been successful at creating the results that so many communities are calling for. We are very proud to be the safest major city in the country. We are at record low levels of gun violence, of homicide, of all the public safety statistics that are tracked on an annual basis. And that is because of the trust that exists within our community and the ability for everyone to be involved, to have investments that improve people's lives. So we're still evaluating what the next steps are on that front. And should it come to that, I think I would also need to understand the breastfeeding policies for those who are testifying as well.
What kind of questions are you getting either from local law enforcement there in Boston or from people in your city without legal status? Questions about the deportation threats coming from federal government officials?
I think we are very clear in Boston that the results we've achieved have been because we create a space where everyone is part of our community. That means that regardless of your immigration status or anything else about your background, everyone needs to feel comfortable and safe reaching out to law enforcement, reporting crimes, calling 911 when you need help, taking your kids to school, being involved in activities at the community center. And we do not ask about immigration status in any of those settings. At the same time, we are very clear that there's accountability across the board as well for those who have committed a crime or who are perpetrating violence or harm in the community. And so that's the foundation of how we are building our city here.
Boston Mayor and Mom Michelle Wu, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
The tech founder Reid Hoffman watched many tech leaders take the inauguration stage with the new president he had opposed. Hoffman says he's okay with that.
If I were to pick one industry that I would most want to be in dialogue with the president's office and with the American government, it's the tech industry.
But is he worried about retribution? A tech leader who was not invited on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. The Trump administration says it's moving ahead with its plan to deport migrants in the U.S. to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
We're leading forward on supporting the president's directive to make sure that we have a location for violent criminal illegals as they are deported out of the country.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The U.S. Transportation Secretary says 67 people died in last night's mid-air collision between an Army Black Hawk helicopter and an American Airlines passenger jet. Federal aviation investigators are on the scene in Washington to begin the long process of figuring out what caused the crash over D.C.'s Potomac River. Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia knows the Reagan Airport well, as do many other lawmakers who fly in and out of Washington when Congress is in session.
A number of us have been sounding the alarm about congestion for some time. The good news is the National Transportation Safety Board does have a very, very good reputation for conducting these investigations, and we believe we will get the answers about what happened, and we may get some answers soon.
The collision happened in one of the nation's busiest airspaces. It's now the deadliest in 24 years. Meanwhile, without evidence, President Trump blaming diversity hiring for the incident. Last week, he signed an executive order banning the FAA's diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. In New York, an appeals panel has struck down a controversial court ruling that was threatening state-level voting rights around the country. NPR's Hansi Long tells us that ruling found that New York's legal protections against racial discrimination in voting violate the Constitution.
Eight states have passed state voting rights acts, and advocates are pushing for more as critics of the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965 keep chipping away at that landmark law in court. A state judge struck down New York's Voting Rights Act in November for violating the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. But now an appeals panel has reversed that ruling after finding the law allows any racial group that makes up a minority in their community to file a lawsuit claiming their collective voting power has been diluted. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished higher on Wall Street after the economy expanded in the final quarter of last year. This is NPR. In eastern Congo, the leaders of the Rwanda-backed rebels held their first news conference today after capturing the city of Goma. They also raised the prospect of further expanding their control of the mineral-rich region. Emmett Livingstone has more.
It was the first time the residents of Goma, an important mining and transport hub in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, were being addressed by their new leaders, the M23 rebel group and its political branch, the AFC. The message was loud and clear: we're here to stay. The Tutsi-led rebel leaders also announced that Congo's government is corrupt and that their aim was for every ethnic community to be treated fairly. They also promised to restore internet and electricity in the city of more than 2 million people, blaming the government for outages. The Rwanda-backed M23 fighters, armed and in battle fatigues, are a strong presence across the city, which still bears the signs of the recent battle. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Goma.
Civil rights activists are calling for a boycott of Target stores after the retailer dropped its diversity, equity, and inclusion programs last week. Joining several other American brands in scaling back their DEI goals and activities, big corporations are feeling the pressure from conservatives and the new Trump administration over their diversity initiatives. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher today. The tech-heavy NASDAQ up a quarter. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
On a Thursday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. More than a dozen passengers on the American Airlines flight that crashed last night near Washington, D.C. were young elite figure skaters, as well as their coaches and family members. They were returning home from a competition in Wichita, Kansas. And today, the figure skating community is in mourning over their loss. Authorities have said there are no survivors. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan has been talking with some of the people in this tight group. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
How much do we know at this point about who exactly was on the plane?
Yeah, we're still awaiting confirmation on the full list of names, but I can share details about some of them. Two teenage figure skaters, Gina Hahn and Spencer Lane, who were on their way back to their homes in New England. Both of them were members of the Skating Club of Boston, which is one of the oldest training clubs in the country. They were traveling with their mothers, Jen Hahn and Christine Lane, who are also on the flight, along with two coaches who were based in Boston. They were Jenya Shishkova and Vadim Nomov, a husband and wife pair, who were competitors themselves for Russia back in the 1990s. They were world champions then, coaches now. In addition to those six, we know that there were others too, some of them from the D.C. area, although we're still waiting to confirm those details.
We mentioned that they were coming home from a competition. Tell us more about why they were in Kansas.
Yeah, so there was a major competition in Wichita last week, the U.S. Figure Skating Championships. That wrapped up on Sunday. And then for a few days afterward, U.S. Figure Skating, which is the governing body for the sport in this country, held a development camp for elite young skaters. So this group was largely returning home from that development camp, which is especially tragic because it's a major achievement to be invited to a camp like that, meaning the athletes who are on the plane were some of the most promising young figure skaters in the country who had just had one of the most exciting achievements of their young careers. And then it, you know, turned into tragedy. These are athletes who may have had dreams of competing in the Winter Olympics, not next year. They're a little too young for that probably, but perhaps in 2030.
Yeah. So given all that, how is the figure skating community absorbing this news?
I mean, obviously, people are devastated. I think I can't emphasize enough that this is just not that big a world, this figure skating community, a very small group of these elite athletes and coaches who are regularly flying all across the country for competitions and training camps. And so to lose them like this has really shocked people. One of them we heard from today is Doug Zagheib. He's the head of the Skating Club of Boston, that training club that we mentioned that some of these skaters and coaches belong to. And here's how he put it this morning.
Skating is a very close and tight-knit community. These kids and their parents, they're here at our facility in Norwood 6, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a close, tight bond. And I think for all of us, we have lost family.
I think you can really hear it in his voice there, just how hard this is hitting.
Yeah, you know, Becky, at our planning meeting this morning for today's show, one of the staff members mentioned this eerie fact, which is that there was another plane crash in 1961 mm-hmm. involving U.S. figure skaters. I hadn't known that. That's true?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, that was a flight from New York to Brussels that was carrying what was then the entire U.S. figure skating team en route to a world competition in Prague. They all died in that crash. Back then. And so I think that's part of what has been so shocking and upsetting to this community today. You know, back then it was like you lost this entire generation of top level athletes plus their coaches. And I think those who have been around the U.S. figure skating world for a long time will tell you that it did take decades for the sport here to recover from that crash. And so now today, losing all these talented young skaters and their coaches, there's a sense that, you know, not only is it a loss for right now, but it's also a loss for the future of the sport as well. And folks are just feeling like, how is it possible that this could have happened to us twice?
Right. Huge reverberations for years to come. That's NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thank you, Becky.
You're so welcome.
The Trump administration says it is moving ahead with a plan announced yesterday to use the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to house up to 30,000 migrants deported from the United States. Here is Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth speaking today.
We're leaning forward on supporting the president's directive to make sure that we have a location for violent criminal illegals as they are deported out of the country, and we're working that in real time.
How realistic is that proposal? Well, my co-host today, Sasha Pfeiffer. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, Mary Louise. You've been next to me here.
Yeah, good to have you in the studio with me. You've been covering this question about how to use Guantanamo. You've been trying to answer that very question. What have you learned?
So I have learned that although the Trump administration confidently says it will make this happen, and we've heard that not just from Trump himself and from Defense Secretary Hegseth, but from Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and Border Czar Tom Homan, despite their confidence, they're going to face a lot of hurdles in carrying out this plan. The first is funding.
Okay, so let's follow on that one. I'm imagining that transporting 30,000 people to a Caribbean island and then housing them and feeding them and supervising them for we don't know how long, that would not be cheap.
Exactly. And the administration has not said how much it would cost, but it says it expects Congress to allocate the money. It is not clear that Congress would do that. For comparison's sake, the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo, which is where alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has held, that has cost U.S. taxpayers more than $6 billion since it opened in 2002, and it is still open. At its height, it held just under 800 people. Now imagine the cost of holding 30,000 people at a migrant detention facility that still needs to be set up.
Which prompts the question, might members of Congress, including Republicans who support Donald Trump, might they balk at that kind of cost?
Yes, and that's what one of the people I interviewed thinks. I called the editor of the legal website Lawfare, Ben Wittes, and he said Congress might hesitate. Here he is with the hypothetical.
You can create it, you can bring people there, but then 20 plus years later, you're stuck with it and you're trying to get rid of them one by one. And so I think there will be a lot of members of Congress who are not so eager to fund it.
So that's Ben Wittes telling you, Sasha, about some of the cost obstacles. What about things not related to money? I'm thinking legal hurdles. Can this be done legally? Can the Trump administration legally deport migrants to Guantanamo?
It appears yes, but if migrants deported from the U.S. are sent to Guantanamo, they are still entitled to certain legal rights under U.S. law because they were in the U.S. And those rights do not disappear just because they're suddenly in Cuba. That means there should be no legal benefit to deporting them there.
So why do this? What's the point of sending them to Guantanamo if it, A, could be really expensive, and B, there are no legal advantages?
Ben Wittes of Lawfare believes that there's an intentional symbolism to the Trump administration wanting to use Guantanamo.
The name Guantanamo Bay to Americans signals terrorist detention. So it elevates the status of what are really routine immigration enforcement actions into something like holding major terrorist figures. It signals, I'm going to bring back the big bad Guantanamo Bay for this.
And Mary Louise Wittes says the administration could hold migrants somewhere else, like somewhere in the middle of our country, but that wouldn't attract as much attention and it wouldn't send as much of a macho message.
So bottom line, what is the setup to? How likely is it that the Trump administration will ultimately end up sending 30,000 people to Guantanamo Bay?
A Georgetown University law professor I interviewed is skeptical that would actually happen, but he does think that some migrants could be sent there as a spectacle of sorts, a kind of a flex of U.S. muscle. This is Georgetown professor Steve Vladek.
The logistical and just practical hurdles that the government would face if they tried to do this on anything other than a purely superficial, sensationalist scale, I think are really ultimately going to be daunting.
But as we heard the defense secretary say a few minutes ago, the Trump administration says all systems are go.
Sasha, thank you for your reporting on this and for hosting with me today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
This is NPR News. One of the top sources of added sugar in children's diets is in their breakfast bowls. A new study shows that advertising aimed directly at kids is driving sales of high-sugar cereals, and it's having a negative impact on children's diets. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
If you've spent any time watching kids' TV, this will sound familiar.
Can't control myself? I'm going Google for Google Puffs! Google for Google Puffs! Google for Google Puffs!
From Cocoa Puffs to Frosted Flakes, these breakfast cereal commercials feature colorful cartoon characters that appeal directly to kids.
The ultimate chocolatey experience, Cocoa Puffs cereal, part of a good breakfast.
Kids' cereals are the most heavily advertised food product to children. Jennifer Harris is with the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Health at the University of Connecticut. She says the most heavily advertised brands have as many as 12 grams of sugar per serving. That's about a tablespoon.
Cereal companies do have healthy products, but the high sugar ones are the ones that they actually advertise to kids.
In a new study published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, Harris and her colleagues looked at all cereals purchased by U.S. households over a 9-year period. They also looked at Nielsen's rating data, which closely monitored all the ads that people in a household see.
We looked at what children see versus what adults see in terms of advertising on television.
What they found was a strong relationship between how much advertising was targeted to kids and how much sugary cereals households bought. In fact, 9 cereals dominated sales, and all of them were high in sugar. By contrast, ads targeting adults didn't seem to influence purchases.
The study shows that it's really important for these companies with high sugar cereals to actually reach kids, that parents probably wouldn't buy them if their kids weren't asking them for them.
Now, public health officials have long been concerned about the marketing of unhealthy foods to kids. That's why nearly 2 decades ago, the food industry launched the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative, a voluntary effort to police itself. Companies pledged to cut back on marketing unhealthy foods to children under 12, later revised to under 13. But Lindsay Smith-Taley, a food policy researcher at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, says these voluntary efforts aren't making a difference.
For a long time, we've known that junk food marketing to kids was very prevalent in the United States and that it continues to be prevalent despite companies pledging to do better.
Smith-Taley says these commercials can create long-term preferences for unhealthy products.
We have good data to show that behaviors that are learned in childhood track into adulthood,
which can lead to poor health outcomes over a lifetime. We reached out to the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative. In a statement to NPR, they note that the study only looked at ads through 2017. They point to a 2024 study showing children's exposure to cereal ads on TV has dropped dramatically. The author of that study told us that's because TV viewing has declined. And advertisements, like kids' eyeballs, are moving online. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. There is something new happening with a very old diet staple, and NPR host Brittany Luce took notice.
I have been thinking so much about our culture's current obsession with protein. Despite the fact that many doctors and researchers feel that most Americans already get more than enough protein each day, many Americans are trying to find ways to consume even more protein. Now protein's being advertised on pancake mix, in candy bars, and on ice cream pints. It's kind of maddening if you really think about it.
Brittany thought about it and explored this phenomenon on a recent episode of It's Been a Minute. That's the NPR podcast that unpacks some of the biggest cultural happenings and tells us why these trends matter. Brittany told me more about why so many people and products seem to be putting this macronutrient all up in our faces these days.
Well, okay, there's definitely the emphasis of protein as a method for weight loss and also for gaining muscle mass. So it's got a good reputation right now with pretty much anyone looking to change their body composition. But there are two other really interesting things going on with protein culturally. So first, I was talking to food writer Samantha Maxwell, and she noted that protein is one of the few macronutrients that hasn't been villainized. Like, think about like fat or carbohydrates. Like, you go back to the low fat diets of the 90s or the Atkins low carb craze of the 2000s. But protein, it's never really had a quote unquote bad reputation.
Right. Okay. You said there were two cultural things going on here. That was the first one. What's the second?
Well, this is the one that gets me the most. A big reason why protein has never really gotten a bad rap among modern dieters is because it's a masculine macronutrient. Mm. It's the nutrient for men. People of all genders need protein. It's just that protein, because of its relationship to muscle growth, has been masculinized. And thus, certain high-protein foods, like meat, also become masculinized. Vox senior correspondent Kenny Torella shared with me some examples of where this pops up in culture.
You know, I think men are advertised to eat a lot of meat to be manly. I mean, there was a Burger King commercial, I think like 10 years ago or so, was called I Am Man.
I am man, hear me roar. In numbers too big to ignore. And I'm way too hungry to settle for chick food.
And it was all these men kind of joining together, singing this song, saying that they were going to wave tofu goodbye. But we see this also in pop culture. I mean, think of like Ron Swanson in Parks and Recreation.
Yeah.
He was kind of this hyper masculine figure who was always eating bacon.
I call this turf and turf. It's a 16-ounce T-bone and a 24-ounce porterhouse. I'm going to consume all of this at the same time because I am a free American.
So, I mean, men and dieting, it is not something we talk about that frequently.
No, you're absolutely right. But maybe we should, because you're exactly right. This is about a kind of dieting. And it seems like food and nutrition companies have found a way to even more explicitly tap into a wider diet market by focusing on masculinized diet trends.
Speaking of those masculinized trends, there is one more influencer that you mentioned in your episode. And it's someone who's known as the Liver King. Am I getting that right?
Yes, the Liver King. His legal name is Brian Johnson, but he goes by the Liver King on many social media platforms. He has millions of followers, and he is this social media and fitness influencer whose main focus was being totally ripped, okay, having a very, very, very muscular physique, walking around in the woods in gym shorts and no shirt and eating raw meat. I mean, and he didn't just make content out of this. He spun this out into actual like products, like liver pills. And then it was found that he was spending thousands upon thousands of dollars every single month on steroids to actually achieve his physique. But yeah, it was interesting for me as a woman who's been inundated with diet content for my entire life to see that there were so many men who had that same experience of being sold one type of, you know, body that it could be achieved in only one kind of way. But I do want to say before we go that while this is the culture around a macronutrient, it also points at a bigger trend, which is that this current protein obsession all points to a desire for Americans at large to want to live and eat healthier, regardless of how they might go about that.
And I know that there are also some political implications in this cultural conversation too, and you can hear more about that in the full episode of It's Been a Minute. Brittany, thank you so much for bringing some of this to the show.
Thank you for having me.
That was Brittany Luce. She's the host of It's Been a Minute from NPR. And you can listen to It's Been a Minute every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Fans are tuning in to a new season of so-called Eagle TV, a 24/7 camera trained on the nest of two eagles in Southern California. Last year ended in heartbreak when the eagles' eggs did not hatch. Fans are hoping for a better outcome this time. From member station KVCR in San Bernardino, Madison Aument reports.
Snow crunches under Sandy Steer's feet as she hikes down to Big Bear Lake in the San Bernardino Mountains east of Los Angeles. Steers is the mastermind behind the live feed. She stops at a clearing and focuses her binoculars on a 145-foot pine tree where the camera is mounted.
You can see it right above the horizon there.
The eagles who live there are known as Jackie and Shadow.
With all the snow, you can't really see the eagles in there right now.
Steers thinks Jackie is the same chick she first noticed out here almost 15 years ago, though there's no way to know for sure.
I would stand out here no matter what the weather for a few hours a day just to watch this little chick on the nest, and it was beautiful to watch, and it got me hooked into all of this.
Jackie and Shadow debuted on screen in 2015, but viewership skyrocketed a few years later when tens of thousands of people logged on to see if Jackie's eggs would hatch, which they did. People were mesmerized by the eagle's antics. Here, the live stream shows Shadow flying in with a fish for Jackie.
It's almost like they know they're on a television show and they're putting on special skits all day long.
Though the past two seasons, it's been tough for viewers when no eaglets arrived.
Sometimes nature's hard to watch.
Last year, Jackie left the eggs after there was no chance they would hatch, and ravens swooped in to eat them. It's not clear why the eggs failed. Eagle experts say there could be a number of reasons. Maybe they weren't fertilized or got too cold. The only way to know is to test them, and so far they haven't. But in the past few days, Jackie laid three new eggs.
It's another year of hope.
Steer says the trio arrived at the perfect time, for people in Southern California at least, who need something to look forward to after the wildfires.
A lot of people have been tuning in because they want something pleasant, something that makes them feel good, that they can smile about to watch compared to a lot of the other news and things going on. And we've had people say that it gives them hope that things can recover and nature still continues on and keeps moving no matter what kind of things are going on.
If the eggs are going to hatch, it'll be around early March. For NPR News, I'm Madison Aument at Big Bear Lake.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at Progressive.com/careers. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives.
Let's all begin.
You bring the women.
You bring the women.